All right, everyone, welcome to the RSP cast. This is Scout Talk with Russ Landy and myself, Matt Waldman. And the combine's coming up, Russ. And I just wondered, you know, is there anything that you would change about the NFL combine with the hope of improving it? You know, anything you'd add in terms of workouts or eliminate or alter about the event as a whole?
Well, you know, the biggest thing I would do, first and foremost, is I would try – I personally, and I know teams would probably want to murder me for saying this. I would try to, instead of making it a 7 or 8 day thing, I really think it would be great if you could make it almost a 2 week thing, because I think one of the things that's missing here is how do we get the interviews? How about we, instead of teams getting limited to, say, 40 or 50 or 60 interviews of 15 minutes each, and I know that's being tweaked a little this year because the workouts are at night, how about have it where there's a whole day for each position group where all they have the whole day is they can interview, and set it up where no kid has to interview for more than like an hour and a half straight. If they have 6 interviews in a row, they can take a break. But at least this way, maybe every team could interview 160 or 180 kids, because it would really make things a lot easier for the All-Star game circuit. Because, and I'm sure you've seen it, like the Mobile, when the practice ends, some of these players end up on the field for 40 minutes afterwards because of the line of 7 scouts who have to ask some questions. Whereas if each team at the combine knew, hey, any kid that's coming to the combine, we're going to get our time. I think that would be really good.
Yeah.
I also think if they could do it where the positional drills, where they do it out on the field, if they could maybe slow it down a little bit in terms of not rush through so much, let between reps, give a little bit of time so that the coaches can really put their thoughts down on paper instead of having to jot 1 or 2 notes. Give a little bit more time. I think that would allow the coaches and the scouts that are watching a chance to more thoroughly write down their notes of what they're seeing. Because even though you can go back and look at the video after, when you're right there in the moment, you see things, you notice things, and having a little time between the workouts or between each guy's positional drill, I think would help just the process overall.
That's an interesting thought, too, because it also seems different than what we think about in this day and time with video for everything. When you talk about seeing things that you know, in real time, that, yeah, you could go back and look at the tape. But can we kind of explore that for a minute? Because it's interesting, as someone who watches tape and someone who then goes to and watches things up close, where do you reconcile things that you see, you know, see in real time and see things that you see on tape? Because sometimes I'll do that and I'll go, well, that looked a lot different on tape than what I remember my feeling about it was, or my takeaway about it was when I watched it up close.
Well, firstly, you know as well as I mean, sometimes you're watching, you have a great view of something, and then you see the video and you're like, wait, that doesn't look right. But you forget it's a different angle or whatever it may be, in terms of the view is not the same. For me, some of the things I look for is, like, when I watch those positional drills, there are times before the drill or after the drill, you can really get a feel for their emotions. Like a kid that may struggle, do you see him afterwards, like his shoulders are down, he's given up, and it's like, oh, you, and then the next drill, he struggles, and you can just see the beginning of the end there. Or is it one of those kids that just, he realized slipped, but he got up, and after the drill, he's like, all right, let's move on, let's get in. Those little things, they don't keep on those cuts. They only keep the drill. So the way the kid acts, walking up to the drill, questions he may ask, not so much you're going to hear the question, but just seeing him interact. And the movement skills, sometimes when you watch the film, even though you can technically see it, you don't get as natural a feel, because it seems like, oh, rewind, fast forward. You don't get that natural sense for, you know, is he really moving smoothly? And things like that. I think having that time to put down, because I know I've seen a lot of the O-line coaches, when they get up there, they often have the names of everybody in just a line, and all they do is put checks for good and minuses for bad. And it's like, I understand, that's great. So at the end, you can say, oh, this player had 12 checks and this had 3. But what about if you had a minute between each player to say, really like this feet, don't think he can bend his knees, just something so you can go back, and not only do you have the checks, but you also have little notes about things, so that when you go back and you watch the video, you can say, yeah, you know, I wrote in here, I like this feat. Let me see if I see that when I actually watch it on the video. And that way you can sort of double check. And I just think there'd be real value if these guys could taste, even if it's a 30 seconds, just so you can scribble something. It just would make life, I think, make this coach's job more efficient or the scout who's ever assigned to watch the positional drills. I think that would really carry some value.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can see that. And, you know, I think from my end, I look at this and certainly there's things that I just think are show business about yeah. some of the drills that I just don't understand. Like this gauntlet drill, I don't understand. I really don't understand it. And maybe I just truly don't understand it in more than just a rhetorical sense. I mean, because I watch this and I go, where does this model what players actually do? And aren't you now just now forcing players to now go through an exercise where they're trying to train for the test as opposed to train for real life? And, you know, who's hitting them? Is there yeah. anybody coming down? Is there anybody flashing in front of their eyes? Like, I would like to see if they're not going to do contact because of the risk of injury and the heightened risk of injury in this event. I would love to see something that's something visual or something that would be low chance of injury, but something that they would have to contend with that would come out of, you know, that would come out of the periphery of their vision that would force them to show focus catching the football, as opposed to something like, let's go through a line and catch as many footballs as we can within a span of time. Because to me, that's silly. You like, you know, you could have a perfectly good receiver who has excellent focus, and really wide receiver play is about focusing on that one target and everything that's in the periphery of what's around it for that one play. So where does it come into play that, you know, that your ability to do it in rapid fire succession? I mean, come into play on the field.
Because I asked a similar question when I first went to the combine the first year when I don't remember which year it was when I was at the Rams, but they brought me to the combine and I'd heard about the different drills. But when I saw the gauntlet, I specifically remember asking one of our coaches when we got back to the facility, and his response was, hey, he said, the hardest thing to judge for a receiver is when he comes out of his break, does he get his hands and head around quick enough? So they're like, this is the closest we can come without putting these guys in an injury situation where at least they got to turn around fast and the ball's on them. And I said, okay, I guess. I mean, if that's really what we're going to say is the only way we can judge that, instead of just having our video department go through and identify the 15 or 20 plays during the season where the ball actually got on them so fast that they had to make the catch, so we're going to judge it on something in shorts and a t-shirt. I mean, I guess maybe. But yeah. That's the explanation I was given. And I understand that maybe 20 years ago, when to ask your video department to pull that on all the top, say, 30 receivers might have been a task that would have taken ages and ages and ages. But now when you have stuff like Pro Football Focus, where they actually have they mark for contested catches, all you have to do if you're a scout in the NFL, you just pull up whatever it may be, Justin Jefferson, type in his name, and all the stats pull up, and you can literally highlight contested catches, click it and press play, and it'll have all 20 of them there, or 30, whatever it may be. So it's a lot easier now to do it. I almost look at that as say, okay, I can understand 20 years ago the reason for that, but I think now it's probably long since lost its usefulness, but some people just don't want to get rid of it because it's sort of ingrained in who they are.
Yeah. And I can see that. And I like the explanation in terms of what was told to you, but I'm totally with you in terms of what's available today definitely trumps that. And then looking at, I think to me also just the idea of like, is the same thing with workouts when we see, I'd like to see drills that are more diagnostic in thinking as opposed to just the pure physical, like how quickly they can react to certain things. You know, when I think of like pass pro type of drills, we've talked about this in the past with workouts where there's a diagnostic aspect to it, as opposed to just simple, you know, slide with the guy and, you know, and you know which guy's coming, as opposed to having to figure out which guy's going to be coming.
That brings me to a question for you, because I don't know if you've ever seen this drill. I only saw it about, you remember Jack Conklin, the kid who plays for Tennessee?
Yes. Yes.
The year he came out, they had a guard at Michigan State who ended up being an undrafted guy, stuck with the Chargers for a year or two. But when I went to their pro day, I saw a drill I'd never seen it done this way before. It was the typical, you've probably seen the L drill, not for a three cone, but where the lineman starts in the middle of the L. And they literally will say, we'll use the ball and go left, right, back, left, right, to see him move side to side and have to respond to the ball. So I said, okay, that's interesting. But then he would do that with the guy. Then he would throw the ball away and he'd say, all right, now, he goes, this cone is one, that one's two, that one's three. He goes, when I say the number, you slide to that cone. Same drill, but just using numbers. Because he wanted to see how their brain responded to having to think and then move. So in the first rep of it, this undrafted guard who stuck with the Chargers actually looked more fluid and quicker than Conklin. But as soon as they had to switch and it became, you have to think, that kid was done. He literally stopped, fell a few times, turned himself in a complete circle trying to figure out where he had to go, whereas Conklin looked exactly the same. And I was like, now that's a great comparative drill because you're really seeing here's your physical, here's your mental. Which guys can do both the same, whereas the other guy, clearly physically it's there, but he just doesn't have that reaction ability in his brain. And it's not a knock to say he's not smart. It's reaction ability. There are a lot of guys who are very bright, but they just their brain doesn't react instantaneously to be able to do the physical things that they're physically capable of. And that's what happened here. And ever since then, whenever I've worked out linemen or even other positions, I've done it with linebackers and corners and safeties. It's a great tool to pick up that sort of instinctive awareness thing that, or I don't even know if it's instinctive, but reactionary or something. It really, to me, is it shows a lot. I'd love to see them do something like that at the combine.
Yeah, it's like a mind motor link, you know?
Yes, exactly. It's a perfect way to describe it.
Yeah. And I think that that's a, you know, there are, it's interesting how that is because it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like sight reading something, a piece of music, you, to be able to do it on sight. It's like, it's one thing that you can play and do things or hear things well, but you've got, you know, at the same time, you know, when you're given some sort of visual or oral cue, can you move with it? Can you respond, react to it? That makes total sense. I like that.
Well, and you think about it, how do the best players in the league, they survive? Because when things change on the field, you don't see the smoke come out of their ears. They're instantaneously able to adjust. And okay, I have to adjust my route to this and or this, or if I'm a pass blocker, I get just, and I think in football or in any athletic endeavor, the ability to handle adjustments mentally is a huge, huge part of success.
And we make it look, and it's funny because we'll see it as fans and see something like, you know, the Patriots talking on the sideline and saying, all right, you know, we've been using this coverage all half against Watkins, but now we're going to make it look like the same coverage. Yep. But now I want you to run across the field and stay with that guy. And then it turns into that fine play where you see, you know, I think I've profiled it one time where a couple years ago where you had the safety basically stay with a receiver all the way across the field and make an interception in the back of the end zone. And it was one of those plays where, you know, if you watch it from afar, you're just like thinking you wouldn't understand that it was really about making that adjustment. Or an Ed Reed with Peyton Manning basically, you know, showing a look that he knows Manning is going to jump all over, and knowing that he has the athletic ability on top of that to be able to then spin around and cut off a pass that, you know, nobody on earth would find within reason to do. But he was actually baiting someone that way. And I think that that makes sense, is that being able, it does come down to those adjustments, but not only do you have to have the athletic ability, but you also have to recognize information and be able to act on it.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, think about, and you and I know this because we follow it on a sort of an intricate detail, but how many times when you watch a team, and especially if you follow the same team all year round, certain offensive coordinators, you will see them in games early in the year, they will run a play that clearly every time it's a disaster. It doesn't gain yards, doesn't. But when you get into a big game, and like right in that first round of playoffs, they're in the same format, you know what's coming, and boom, it's a different play, and they gain 38 yards because the opponent was so used to them running that terrible play that they ran it 17 times in the regular season, the exact same play out of that formation. And you know that coach, all he did all year was, we're going to keep running this, we're a good team, we're going to be in the playoffs, And when it comes time for it in the playoffs in a key spot, nobody's going to expect it. We're going to hammer. And you see it over and over with guys like Josh McDaniels. They do that throughout the whole year. And then in the playoffs, bang, they hit three or four that nobody expects over the course of three games.
Yeah, and meanwhile, there was someone on Twitter all year whining and carping about the percentages of that play and how bad it was and how they shouldn't be a coach and how these NFL offenses are incompetent, and then turn around and are singing the praises of that person exactly. 4 months later, as if like none of their commentary earlier ever happened.
Well, they don't realize that one thing does, that there is a reason teams set things up. Every game's not in a bubble. It's not a cocoon. You especially now with computers, everything you do is so overanalyzed that you can really set up, especially bad defensive coordinators, you can destroy them with preparation weeks and months in advance with different play calling sets.
Yeah, it's a chess match, and that's fascinating. And it's funny because, I mean, I just, you know, you look at this event and it's, And I think for you, I understand completely with the interviews. I mean, I understand what I wonder about is, it could be a cost effective way of doing it. I know one thing, the city of Indianapolis would probably love it there, you know, just in terms of all the restaurants and service industries, in terms of having a base of, you know, whether it's, you know, 3 to 5 people who are staying 2 weeks, you know, as opposed to, you know, because even if you did it in shifts in some way, you could get it done and it still probably be, and it's not like, you know, it's not like you're bloating a budget for the NFL who already have, you know, has money
so
to burn.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I know Paul Brown's, you know, obviously the joke is that, you know, that the Cincinnati Bengals might be the team that might, you know, raise their hand and say, you know, I don't know if we can fit that many people into the Beetle to come down here to, exactly. you know, to drive up here, in terms of the media's jokes about how cheap the organization is. But, you know, outside of the jokes about them, you know, I understand. And I think that the ability to have those interviews would be great. And I think it would also allow them to maybe start devoting more time to tools and new ways. And there are some new ways of being able to look at the kind of mental emotional component of what players' skills are, you know, and that kind of leads into this next question, which is the Wonderlic, because you know, it's still being used, and it was a test designed basically to test Navy fighter pilots, and it was an intelligence test. And you know, I've written about this in the past, and you know, my theory is that the Wonderlic measures, you know, academic intelligence, much like the ACT or SAT, in a certain way. You can study for that, or it's also a culturally biased test to a degree that it measures how intelligent you are based on the things that our society learns if you've lived the American dream right. Yep. Like if you grew up and went to a suburban high school, you had the option to do the Kaplan test because your parents had more than enough money, or you got exposed to a variety of different activities and you had the soccer mom or soccer dad and took all these different types of, you know, electives and had opportunities after school, and you didn't have to just work, or you didn't just have to come home and sit there, you know, and do nothing but rot your brain on watching television all day, or, you know, if you have one. And so those types of things, the Wonderlic, you know, if you come from that environment, it's just basically, to me, I mean, I hate to say it this way because it just shows how suburban you are, to me, anything.
Either suburban or well off.
Yeah, suburban or well off, you know, as opposed, and certainly there are kids who aren't from those communities who do well, but they've also have been in situations where they've been able to have family or parents or mentors or teachers help create structures for them that supplement what they didn't have. But to me, it doesn't teach, it shows you how smart you are. But then again, you know, we see all over and over again that the plan changes once you get hit in the mouth. And no doubt. Think that, you know, the action of the field, that this layer of intelligence doesn't really show us anything more than how good, how quick they are at learning material. And that's good to an extent, but it's not something that it shows how good they are in the action of things. And I would love to go back and look, but I would be willing to bet that the best Navy fighter pilots probably weren't always guys who did well on the Wunderlich. Yep. And the thing is my theory about this Wunderlich still being used is that the NFL has listened to at least one prominent academic that I've heard on a podcast with expertise in testing, in intelligence testing and emotional intelligence testing. And he's visited the NFL's offices in New York and met with the commissioner and with owners and has explained to them in abundantly clear terms that this test is not a good fit for what they're trying to get from it, in at least in what they're saying in public. And so to me, my theory is the fact that it's still being used is either part of just we don't want to change it, to that I think that people can leak information to manipulate draft stock and ultimately contract value, or create smoke screens and media issues, and just kind of play with, you know, I don't know, just kind of manipulate situations or try to manipulate situations or see how people respond to this kind of thing, whether it's a negotiation ploy or whether it's an opportunity to try and drop, you know, how people, other teams view players. To me, that's the only reason why I think this thing exists. So I wonder what your thoughts are on the Wunderlich and my kind of out there theory about why it's still being used.
Well, I will say I think there are three reasons it's being used. I think one of them is what you just talked about, is I think it definitely provides a way to deceive, manipulate other teams and find out what they're doing. I think the second reason, which I think you'll understand 100% because you and I are about the same age, which is there are a lot of things our parents did that they refuse to admit is not really efficient or smart anymore. And
right.
There are a lot of people in the NFL that will go down swinging and dying that this is the greatest way ever. And they're not going to change. Now, the third reason, and this to me is what I was told it was used for at the Browns. And even when I was doing Blesto, my job, because my job in the spring was to go to all the schools that said they had a prospect for the draft a year and 4 months out, was to measure them, time them, questionnaire, and a Wunderlich. And I remember them explaining specifically that, at least the person that explained it to me said, hey, the Wunderlich is not going to tell us how smart a kid is, and it's not the determining factor in us saying this kid's got a learning problem or whatever. They said the biggest thing, at least Blesto felt the teams wanted, was it's a red flag indicator for any kid that gets a single digit. It means, hey, we better find out why he got a single digit. And to me, if that's your real only reason for using it, if you're only using it as, hey, we just want to catch guys that maybe we don't know there's an issue, then I have no problem with that. As long as you're not saying, hey, this is the end-all, be-all, there are some teams I know that if you're under a 20 on the Wunderlich, they won't look at you as a quarterback. Things like that are ridiculous. But if you're saying, hey, this is a tool, because we're covering 1,000 kids a year, and if there's six that get in the single digits that we have very high scores on, we want to know and go meet with the kid. We want to go talk to him, talk to everybody around this kid to find out what it is. What is it, a reading problem? Neil Smith was a famous one. He got a 4, if I remember.
Yeah, or Marino or Gore Marino or got a 13. Steve McNair.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yep. And sometimes it's just, like you said, it may be cultural, where they grew up, what schools they went to, but sometimes it is legitimate learning disability. Or there was a kid I gave it to, he got a 2. And I remember talking to his coach, and he said, yeah, he came from a junior college, had a 3.0. His first semester at this school, he had a 0.0. We asked him, he's like, yeah, I can't read it right. He goes, I've been passed through the system. No one's ever taught me.
Mm.
So that school, actually between his junior and senior, sent him, he went to kindergarten during the summer, to learn to read.
Wow.
But for an NFL team, it was an indicator, hey, we just have to know coming in, we're going to have to work. This guy is going to need extra time and extra work. So at least you find out, rather than there are 100%, I know there are other tests out there that could probably do a more thorough job. But to me, if you have the other test and this test, if you're only using it for that and you're not going to start making judgments about players based on, I got a 16 and the average is a 24, we're going to say he's dumb. As long as you're not doing stuff like that and it's only for red flags, I have no problem continuing to use it. But my issue is if you try to use it for beyond that, because once you start making decisions and allowing that to influence what you think of a person's true mental ability, that's where you have to me, that's the major concern.
That's fantastic. And I love how you outline how that is used in a positive way. And I hadn't thought
of
that.
Sometimes it is. Some teams will write guys off because of that. But
and that's just
teams,
yeah.
It's just dumb. Yeah. I mean, there were a number of guys, and I'm not trying to dominate this discussion you're mad on this topic, but
I love it. Keep going.
There were three or four guys I came across at the Browns. I remember they all got single digits from my area, and one was a quarterback. Who ended up playing over a decade in league. He can get a single digit, but 10 out of 41.
Right.
And I remember going to his head coach, and I went to talk to him. He said, it's the damnedest thing. He goes, whenever he has to take a test in class, whenever he has to take our weekly quiz here, like preparing for an opponent, whatever that they give their quarterback, he said he bombs. He said he just isn't able to read and translate. He goes, we've had him tested for dyslexia, learning disability, whatever, nothing. He said he just doesn't translate verbiage in his head and be able to spit it out. But he said as soon as we put him on the practice field, we start testing him on the same thing, and he can see it visually, like people moving. He said he didn't even get one wrong. So it's like, okay. Right. It's like, all right, certain guys are visual learners, certain guys are book learners. And that is a hugely valuable tool to know, well, for any player, but especially a quarterback.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there is a value, but I think any of the teams that are dumb enough, and there are 100%, I'd say at least half the teams are dumb enough, that they put in an inordinate amount of weight on the Wonderlic and will literally eliminate quarterbacks. Centers are a big one. A lot of teams have the 20-point. If you don't get a 20 as a center, you're off our board, things like that. And to me, it's just ridiculous. All it should mean is, if a guy gets single digits, why did he get single digits? Let's go figure it out, because there's a reason, and we need to find out.
And yeah, because if you
– go ahead.
Yeah, because if you know that – I mean, if you know your resources aren't good enough to be able to educate and train in a certain way, and you don't want to spend the time or the investment when you feel like that there's two other players who you think could offer similar level of talent, then I get it. Okay,
yep,
I totally.
You're an employer, right?
Yeah.
You can decide that.
But if you're looking at a guy and you're like, before this test, we thought this guy could be special and he could be a game changer for what we do, and we're all in on him. And then they take the test and they score below 20, and you're going to be like, nah, we're done. It's just like that's completely ill-advised in terms of what you could get, what you could wind up doing to tweak your infrastructure so that you can make this player have the best possible career. Because if you're willing to invest in some of the ridiculous things that I think, or thing, I won't call them ridiculous, invest in some of the things that are, you know, in the past, like hiring private, you know, police officers to accompany players to clubs on Thursday and Friday nights and Saturday nights to make sure that they make it on the team flight, you know, then you should be able to spend maybe a little more money on coaching or certain types of teaching, or spend some time investing in ways to just work smarter so that you can help a player out who doesn't have that issue.
Yep.
and who's going to give you far more dividends long term, hopefully, on the field.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, just the simplest way I look at it is say, I understand, and I completely have no problem. If you're a winning organization, you have a strong coaching staff, and you identify a player, and he does badly on the Wonderlic, and your research, you talk to people, and everything you find out is, hey, he's not a dumb kid, but here's how he learns. And your staff, you've been successful because your coach that teaches that position does not teach the way that's going to help this guy. But fine. You feel, hey, you don't want to vary from that because you've been successful. Hey, that's fine. At least you're doing your research, identifying the way he learns and saying, hey, he's not going to learn properly from the guy that's coaching that position. So let's move on. There's nothing wrong or unjust about that. It's when you make a snap judgment and just say, oh, got a 17. He's probably stupid. We can't bring him in. It's like, wait a second. How do you know? That's where the dumb part, and that's where the risk of the wonder that comes in is. There's so many people older, and even a lot of these young scouts, when they see a single digit or even a low double digit score, they immediately want to say, oh, this guy's an idiot. And it's like, let's take a deep breath here. Let's remember that this test doesn't test for everything. All it tests for is really sort of a base linear, quick thinking, problem solving. It's not based on everybody's background and everybody's educational sort of learning experience. And that's something that's got to be sort of checked out and made sure that you're finding everything out about a player. To me, if you base it on just the Wonderlic, you're sort of throwing out all the, I mean, how you spend a year preparing for the draft, and you're going to change your grade based on a little 3-minute Wonderlic test or 12-minute Wonderlic test. You're throwing a player out because it's like, it's insane.
Yeah. Cause what if there's like, you know, there's certain quarterback, for example, we could probably say there's 3 to 4 different types of quarterback styles that have been really successful in the NFL. And you can probably give the archetypes of those players, and at least 2 of them, if not 3 of the 4, are not the big, strong, and I'm big, strong, white suburban kid who got some sort of extra quarterback coaching, who's a good athlete who throws the ball hard. Yep. You know, it's there are other ways to win the game, and I think that what happens is that you get, you know, the part of scouting that happens is that even the scouts can sometimes not be aware of their own biases and have this whole templatized look of things where they just automatically, they see that number and they're like, yeah, well, not smart enough. When it's more like, no, there's a different thing operating here. Obviously there's a different way they're going about it. How well versed am I in all the different ways that players can be successful? And as a result of that, also be able to recognize then the inherent intelligence and creativity and intuitive skill that these players have and the differences that are with that. Because this game could have easily gone in a different evolutionary perspective, and we could have been looking at guys like the Russell Wilsons of the world or the Lamar Jacksons of the world, who are 2 different types of prototype, you know, archetypes, if you ask me. And we could have, those could have been the standard. And then a Tom Brady could have come along, or a Carson Palmer, what might be a better example, could have come along, and we would have said, I don't know if he can do this, because he can run some, but he can only really throw on rollouts. And most of the time he has to stay in the pocket. I just don't know if NFL offenses are fit for someone to just stand there in the pocket and stand in there and make these throws. I mean, yeah, he can cover the field, but where's his opportunity to be able to like freeze the defensive end or the outside linebacker with the RPO or with the read option? You know, I mean, we can't even play 11-on-11 offensive versus defense football with him. You could have just completely gone like Planet of the Apes with this entire thing, you know, with quarterbacks, and it could have been a completely different universe where we'd be looking at the Carson Palmers, Dan Marinos, and Tom Brady's and saying, we don't know if they can play. Sure, they're smart, you know, in terms of like book smarts, but there's a different kind of intelligence that they have to prove they have. And so I think it does just come down to the predominant way the game evolved has caused people to not be able to understand that there are different archetypes. And I love the way that you explain the Wonderlic, because just to be able to look at it and say it's more nuanced than it's dumb to do, we shouldn't be doing it at all. I get it as a tool that says, let's find out. It's a big net that's all it is.
We're not talking about scouting 50 guys. If the NFL only had scouted 50 guys a year, even if they had to scout only 255, if they said, here's the 255 guys that are eligible for the draft next year, that's it. You know what? You wouldn't even need the Wonderlic, because you'd be able to find out. But remember, the list starts at 3,500.
Yeah.
So you've got to have these numbers, because even now, at this point, there are going to be 10 or 15 names that pop up in the spring for NFL teams. And if a guy pops up and someone throws on the film, like, wait a second, this guy has great testing numbers. His film is ridiculous. He got a 4. We better go find out why.
Yeah.
So at least having that information allows you to be protected in that, hey, if something pops up and he has a low score, we got to go find out why. Let's get on the phone to the coach and find out. Yeah. If you make a perfect, it's a perfect, it's a net. It helps you sort through and catch any red flags in this one area for 3,500 or 4,000 people.
Right. Right. And that makes total sense. That makes total sense. And it's funny because you think about, you talked about teams that may have established ways of doing things. And I've joked a lot that I feel like that the New England Patriots, if they have a weakness in terms of how they pick players, that they've really had a weakness that's been acknowledged by Bill Belichick in recent years with wide receiver. That's yep. a position that they've struggled getting. But they're a team that when you look at how they've worked out, you know, they do bring in a lot of players that have a certain level of intelligence and in how they approach their job, how they do things, where they may not be guys that would have been picked at the top of the draft all the time, or maybe even in the second day of the draft, but they're guys that can fit their system and do what they want, and they can kind of churn through a lot of these guys on a level and have a lot of success when it comes to supporting, you know, actors in their schemes. Yep. So, you know, one of the things about, you know, the Patriots that I've always found also interesting is obviously their Bill Belichick's love of the tight end. And, you know, when listening to him in the NFL's top 100 growing up, you know, watching the Baltimore Colts and then talking about John Mackey and the profound, you know, how much of a fan he was of Mackey. And it's obvious that Mackey had a profound impact on his view of the tight end's role in an offense. And I think this, you can even look at the two tight ends he had in Detroit in the 70s. I don't remember the second guy, but Charlie Sanders was the first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then you have the whole Hernandez and Gronkowski. And I think that, you know, you look at that, and I think that players influence scouts and coaches and personnel executives in the same ways that maybe an author or actor or musician influences, you know, other writers and thespians and performers. So with Belichick growing up on the Colts, you know, you can kind of see, you know, maybe where some of the positive biases are in terms of how they've influenced the way that he looks at certain aspects of the game. So I'm wondering, you know, who are some of the players you grew up on, and how do you think those players influenced your evaluation of talent, and how do they, and either positively or in ways that you thought about and said that created biases that I had to address as I evolved in this profession?
Well, you know, I'll give you, firstly, it starts with two, and it's really one guy that is Dan Fouts, because I grew up a Chargers fan. So, I mean, I grew up watching Fouts and seeing this guy who, I mean, he couldn't avoid you or I if we were right. rushing the passer. But he stood there, and he would just throw it literally as guys were literally – four guys would be hitting him, but his arm would squirt through and throw the ball as he just gets driven into the ground. And so I grew up thinking, man, I want a guy where the ball comes out fast, who's fearless and just stands there forever. And that was sort of what got me started when I was like following football. I said, wow, that's what I want. But the problem was in their division, they were the Broncos. And yeah. it was sort of the antithesis of, there's Elway who, and I'm not knocking Elway, he was a great player, but Elway was never the type who would sit in the pocket to the last minute and just get blown up. Because as soon as he was like, you know what, I don't see an easy way here, I'm getting out. And at so many times, and I'm sure you saw it for all the years in the, mm-hmm. either late in the season, the playoffs, it would be 3rd and 11, and your pressure would be on Elway, and you'd be like, shh, we got him. All right, play. And then he'd squeeze through, pop out, and either make a throw or run for 14 yards. And that was really – I had always been the guy who was like, hey, you have to be a pocket passer when I first started watching Fouts and stuff. But the more I saw Elway do that, I kept saying, gosh darn, I said, the limitations – and don't get me wrong. I'm always going to sure. take the elite pocket passer over a marginal pocket passer who's a better athlete. But if they're close to equal, the guy who can do something to extend the play and avoid sacks, 100%, the value that brings – and seeing Elway do that over and over and over to my Chargers, it really made me think, you know what? It's great to have a guy like Fouts, but man, if I could have a guy, even thinking back to a guy like a Brian Sipe, who was not a great yes. quarterback, but he could escape. He could pop yes. out and avoid and throw something. And it really taught me early on. It's like, yeah, you know, I love Fouts, and he's going to be one of my all-time favorites when all goes down. I got his jersey hanging in my office. But if I were molding a quarterback, I want a guy who can at least escape a little bit. And I mean, Brady and Manning, they could move within the pocket. But I'd really rather have a guy who can even get out of the pocket, because to me, that's an invaluable trait. And that, I think that was one of the big ones. The Fouts-Elway thing for me, when I grew up and then getting into scouting with the Rams, it was something that I slowly started to realize that you have to find that balance. But I hate to be trapped. Not trapped isn't the right word, but I really don't want to have a quarterback who is so limited athletically that he cannot help me when things start to go astray.
Love it. Love it. And I think there's two players for me that kind of do that for me. And they're two different positions, but they have the common thread. One of them is Billy Johnson, the wide receiver, punt returner for the Oilers. Yeah. So White Shoes Johnson, getting a chance to watch him with the Oilers early on and just how exciting he was as an open field runner. And then seeing him in Atlanta. And the joke in Atlanta used to be in the 80s that they really didn't know how old he was, and he didn't want to tell them how old he was. and he wasn't a full-time receiver for them, but when he was on the field as a receiver, he always seemed to make big plays. And he was one of those guys that was often in the right place at the right time. He made the right move at the right moment, whether it was just turning his body towards the ball in a certain way or being in position to make a play. And he wasn't the fastest. He certainly wasn't a big or strong guy. He had great movement, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
And he had glue hands, you know, he had glue fingered mitts. And he was so. What I liked about him was the same reason that I watched another player who was a big favorite of mine growing up for the Cleveland Browns, which was Ernest Biner. And again, another guy who wasn't inordinately fast. He was big enough to obviously play the position, but he was quick. He had short, you know, he and Johnson both had short area quickness. They both seemed to be they were versatile, and they seemed to be able to be at the right place at the right time, and to be able to make micro movements. I call it micro movements, just like smaller movements that adjust to different scenarios. And it shows the processing speed, the awareness of what's going on in the moment to be able to make small adjustments like that. And to me, those two players taught me that if you can get a player who has those skills and great athletic ability, like saying Ezekiel Elliott, you know, you're going to take that guy 10 times out of 10.
Yeah.
But when you're shopping in the late rounds or the UDFA pool, you know, who are the guys who have that integrative ability to, you know, the ability to just integrate so many different levels of information and different skills in their game to be able to make good plays. And so that helped me out a lot as I started growing into this with running back play and, you know, looking at the Peyton Barbers of the world and saying that guy has value to a team. You know, he may not be a full-time starter long-term, but he's going to outlast guys who have much more, you know, of the eye-popping athletic ability that people will look at the combine in certain arenas that he may not have. But Peyton Barber, I think, will be playing for the next 5 or 6 years at running back. If it's not, you know, co-starting in Tampa Bay right now, he'll be on another team and be a third down player or a situational player who will find his way onto the field on a regular basis and help out that team. And even a team with a better offensive line, you might look at him and go, wow, that guy's actually can gain 1,200 to 1,300 yards as the starter if we needed him in the same way that a Chester Taylor did before Adrian Peterson came to Minnesota. Yep. So those are two guys to me that helped me to understand that speed and strength and size are important, but there are compensatory factors out there, and there are guys who can play at a really high level without the prototypical, you know, factors that we often look at.
And it's funny because you mentioned that one of the guys that I learned that from, similar sort of lesson, and it was sort of looking at him, and you I'm sure remember the guy is Leslie O'Neal, because he played in the NFL 14 years, was this guy was a first round pick. As a rookie, he was on the way to breaking the all-time rookie sack record, and he suffered a catastrophic knee injury back in this 83, where he tore three of the four ligaments in his knee. At that time, nobody ever recovered. Yeah. And it took him 2 years to get back on the field. And I remember when he came back, he didn't have that just rare first step. He used to just be able to one twitch and he was by the tackle. And then when he came back, he ended up still playing another 10 years and had over 100 sacks after his injury. And I remember watching him and seeing, you know what? He doesn't have that twitch, but man, his feet still have that short area quickness. And his hands, he's so violent and strong and so polished with how he uses them. It really taught me that, yeah, it's great. We all would love to have Lawrence Taylor, but that's a once in a generation, maybe once in a 50-year type guy. A guy like Leslie O'Neal, who may have had that before the injury, but the post-injury Leslie O'Neal, which there are a lot of players like that physically coming out in terms of good athletes, not special, if they're polished and they have strong, violent hands and they're efficient and they know how to distribute their weight the right way when they're rushing the passer, they can still be really productive. And that was one of the lessons I learned. I used to focus so much on that first step. They just got to be unbelievably rare in terms of first step quickness. And then the more I saw Leslie continue to be productive, I was like, wow, you don't have to be special athletically. Don't get me wrong, it helps. But if you're just a good athlete who knows how to play the position, plays with great base, knows how to get off of blocks, uses your hands both violently and efficiently, you have a chance to be a really good pass rusher. And it was a lesson I learned, it's similar to what you did with those guys, is you don't always need the best athlete. Sometimes it's the guys with good tools but who know how to use them the best that end up being more productive than those guys with better physical tools.
Yeah, that's why Frank Gore's still in the league. I mean, you look at him, you look at him at when he entered Miami, and I joke around that he's kind of like if Achilles got dipped into the river Styx and his mama held him by like the back of his ankles, you know, I think they lowered Frank Gore in by a crane by the back of his knees.
No
doubt. And basically they pulled him back out and they got everything but the backs of his knees, because before the injuries, you know, when you have Larry Coker, who was the Miami's head coach, who was the running backs coach, who helped recruit Barry Sanders and Thurman Thomas, say Frank Gore was the best high school running back I ever saw. And I'm saying that as the guy who coached Thurman Thomas and Barry Sanders. You know, that's enough right there. And I've seen a little bit of Frank Gore. A lot of it was memory, but I saw some tape recently of him before injury. And yeah, it's insanity. And when you watch him, you know, even three, four years ago when he was basically tutoring Marlon Mack, the differences were striking in how Frank Gore could manipulate a crease. It was like literally watching someone playing poker versus someone playing war, you know, it's such a great thing to watch. So I love the Leslie O'Neal example, and that totally fits.
Which, I have to give you, though, the great story I think I've told you about Frank Gore. I don't know if I've told you. So we're in our draft meetings at the Browns, and it's the year Willis McGahee is coming out. And he ends up being a first-round pick, even though he blew out his knee.
Yeah.
And I still remember when the pick was made, Butch turned to all of us, and he said, you know, Willis should right now commit to 10% of all the money he ever earns in the NFL. He should give it to Frank Gore. Because he said, if Frank never got hurt, Willis would never have seen the field ever because Frank was so much better, and Willis would have to go back and have a normal job getting out of college because he would never play professional football. He said, I hope he gives 10% to Frank, because he said he'll never be the player Frank was before the injury. And I was like,
wow.
Okay. And it turned out he was never the player Frank was after the injury. But still, it was a great line of just how great Frank Gore was. I mean, he's been unbelievable for 15 years in the NFL. It's unreal.
Yeah, it really is. And the fact that, you know, I've had scouts tell me, they're like, oh, yeah, his tape gets passed around by running back coaches to show young players. Like, this is how you run, you know, gap schemes. This is how you run this play, you know. And it's funny because Gore, the guy who also fits that in that regard, is another Miami running back, which is Edgerrin James, who I'm so glad he got in the Hall of Fame, even though I'm not a huge, like, who should be in and who shouldn't be in. Because right now I kind of have a jaded view about all that whole process. But I like seeing him recognized because he was an unbelievable talent the couple years when he came out. The way he could cut and bend was ridiculous, in the way that he could drop his weight at full speed and be able to make a change of direction, and his versatility and the reacceleration quickness and high-end speed he had was unbelievable. And even after the injury, I've never seen someone with the pad level and short yardage ability to get under defenders and to be able to like squeeze through cracks in a way that if it was third and three, third and four or less, and you didn't hand the ball to, you could hand the ball to Willis McGahee and he was going to find a way to find that little crease or crack and create and get under there. And it's that kind of underrated chain moving play that really helped set up play action in ways that, you know, I know that there's a lot of studies that say, you know, you don't have to hand the ball to get effective play action. And I get that on certain down and distances, but the fact that teams had to be aware that at those down and distances that Edger and James was practically automatic and you need to get bodies on him and it still may not help, certainly helped out Peyton Manning passing game on those plays.
No doubt it does. And I'll also tell you just a story for Edger is when I got to work at CBS, I happened to work with Ditka for a year. And this was after the famous New Orleans, the trade and all that. And I asked him, I said, I don't mean to be a pain, but I said, the trade. And he goes, no one would say a word if we traded up for the right back. And I was like, okay. All right.
Wow.
Right there. He goes, no one would have complained if we gave up a whole draft for Edger and James. He goes, we just picked the wrong guy.
Wow. And, you know, and it's sad because, and that's also not, and that's not taking anything away from Ricky Williams' talent on the field.
I don't think he had the love of football.
No, that was totally it. Because Ricky was an unbelievable running back. God, I love both those players, but Ricky Williams, I went to New Orleans for my first, I went on a trip and I've never been the guy who's like, you know, before I was married, if I'd go out on dates or go on away, things was like, oh, let's go see a football game. Like that wasn't my thing. Like I'm going to drag somebody to go see a sport with me. But when we went to New Orleans, I went to New Orleans with my ex-girlfriend. I was like, I wouldn't do this normally, but I want to go see the New Orleans Saints play. And it was the opener to watch Ricky Williams. I wanted to see Ricky Williams play. And I said, we're going to be there. We'll do all, you know, we're going to go listen to music. We're going to go check out galleries. We're going to go do all these different things. But I want to go in Sunday afternoon. And of course, he sprained his ankle in the opener.
There you go. Exactly. That's the way it was going to be. But man, you weren't kidding. He was so, his talent. If he loved it and wanted to just give his body up for the game forever, he would be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, because he was so special. I just don't think he had that pure passion to put football above all else in his life.
Because he had the on-field intelligence. He was a great blocker and receiver. He could do it all as a runner. It was amazing to watch him play, even in the years that he did.
Yes.
Give exactly. Close to 100%. And then in the later years when he got perspective with the Ravens and even watching him then, it's like, wow, you know, it's a what could have been type of thing in that way. But I'm happy for him knowing that hopefully he made peace with where he was with that, because that was probably hard, all the outside expectations, and then deciding, okay, let me get framed and focused with where I am, and this is how I'm going to approach it in perspective, and it could still be helpful. But as scouts, you watch that guy and you wish that, but I'm happy for him outside of that.
Yeah, you just hope he's enjoying life, because man, was he fun to watch. When he wanted it, he was unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely unbelievable. So you know, we got about 5 minutes left here. You know, we'll see how much time we have here, but who's a player that's caught your eye, you know, in recent weeks as you've been studying?
You know, the one guy, and this is a guy that I had seen during the year because I was grading a lot of Big Ten guys, is Cameron Brown, the linebacker from Penn State. I had seen him during the year, and I was like, wow, he's really good in coverage. I was like, I really want to see him up close because he's so smooth and fluid in coverage. I thought, geez, he can't be a big guy because he just moves. He moves like a DB. Then you go down to the combine or the mobile, and there he is. I think he was about 6'2", and he's about 228 or 230. And he's muscular, solid, and wow, he moves so well. I thought, man, after that week in Mobile, now I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen, but when I watch this guy in coverage, I think, man, in today's NFL, a linebacker with that size who's fluid, who can cover deep, he's going to be able to cover tight ends, running backs, he's going to be efficient and productive in zone coverage. I mean, this is a guy I don't think he'll be a first-round pick, but it wouldn't shock me if someone late in that first threw a dart because there's something about this kid athletically that in today's NFL is so valuable. And then when you add in his ability to chase down running plays, his blitzing and pass rush ability when used, I think there's something to this kid that's getting overlooked. And Mobile, he really caught my attention.
Nice. So the guy that's caught mine is also a Big Ten player. He's out of Wisconsin, and he's a wide receiver, and it's Quintez Cephas out of Wisconsin. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, I love this kid, okay? Watching him play, 6'1", 207 is his height, weight, at least listed. This guy understands how to play physically. He, at the top of his stems, he can use his hands, whether it's a rip, an arm over, a swim. He has a plan with his hands. He has a plan with his hands, whether it's off the line or at that top of the stem at the break point. He comes back to the ball well. He can drop his hips and get that sudden stop and turn, catches the ball, elevates well for the ball. He can win the ball in the air. He can take contact. He can dish out contact. He's someone that has the concentration. There's this play at Michigan State that I would be more than happy to say it was a lucky play where he works across the middle in the end zone, gets hit and wrapped by the Michigan State safety, and he basically catches his ball after basically having it bounce off, I think, four or five different points of his frame while he's going down to the ground to catch this ball. But the thing is you watch that once, you go, oh, yeah, that was a great play, great concentration, good focus. It's a one-off play, right? So then I go tune in and I'm watching him against Oregon, who has a pair of excellent cornerback prospects. And here he is working up the sideline on a go route where basically he's getting interfered with, and he knows he's getting interfered with. So he's like, well, what the hell? So he rips his way through and cuts off the defender late in the play and makes this diving catch that he gets one foot in, he doesn't get the other one in, but it's just and then they end up getting, into the red zone. He ends up scoring later on the drive on a play where, I believe it's the safety or linebacker bounces off, hits him and knock. They both fall to the ground and the safety's still on the ground. He pops right back up. The safety tries to pop back up and he's still on the ground. and then later Troy Dye, their standout athlete outside linebacker, tries to lay out Cephas with a crossing route, on a crossing route. And he comes from the flat and just tries to, clean his clock. And Cephas, lowers the pads a little bit, takes the hit, and then uses that free arm to just shove him aside. He just shoves the linebacker aside and continues up the field. And every time I watch him, and then his ball tracking is just out of this world good. I mean, there's a lot of good ball trackers in this class, but to watch a guy, still be able to work, 40, 50 yards downfield and track the ball directly over his head. And
is
then
rare.
And like an outfielder. He looked like Dante Pettis's son, father, Gary Pettis, yep. In center field, just like literally over Willie Mays going over his head and then moving with the ball. Still looking directly up, and his ability to do that, all of that's great. And the reason people don't hear about him is one, you've got Jonathan Taylor in that offense and they're pounding the ball. They don't have unbelievable quarterback play, even for what you would call by good college quarterback center. They have decent quarterback play. And also Cephas, he broke his foot at one point in college, and then he also had a rape charge where he went to trial and it was acquitted. And it was acquitted pretty quickly, and it was a fairly, from what I read of the case, it looked like a pretty open and shut, like, this shouldn't have even gone to trial type of thing. You know, and so I'm no, you know, I'm obviously no prosecutor or defense attorney that knows that kind of stuff, though I do have a family member who works in Boston with, you know, who prosecutes sexual crime cases. So, you know, just from what they've told me about and from what I've talked about in or from what I've read about this case, there's not many questions with this, you know. Yep. So and the team was very supportive in a way that was like, it was quiet, but it wasn't kind of like some of the cases we've seen in the past where, you know, where journalists could kind of poke holes in it and raise a lot of questions about how law enforcement might have been influenced in some way, or pressure might have been applied in some way, or anything that seemed kind of not on the up and up. But with Cephas, this seems so clear cut. So that I look at this, and I'll be interested in what comes out of interviews and things like that. But I would not be at all surprised if Quintez Cephas becomes a good, productive NFL starter in the league who might even become a team's lead receiver at some point. I'm really, really excited about what I've seen from him.
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't study him, but I know I watch a lot of Wisconsin, and there's no doubt. I mean, to me, there's a little bit of Keenan Allen in him in terms of his ability to handle the physical side of the play, which a lot of college guys don't know how to deal with. A lot of college guys are only productive when they have a little bit of space and a little bit of open territory. Whereas this kid knows how to deal with guys saying, I know you're not going to beat me over the top, so I'm just going to beat you up. And he's like, all right, fine. Beat me up. Yeah. I'm going to outwin every contested battle, and I'm going to make the play. And
yeah,
that's rare.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm curious about is how he runs. Because is he a 4? Can he be a 4.5 guy, or is he a low 4.6 guy, or is he faster than what we think? You know, That's what I'm fascinated, because the range to me is, I see guys like Allen makes sense, a guy like Joe Horn or Roddy White, who were like, White was fast, and Horn was fast too. But those two guys were physical too.
Yep, no doubt.
White especially so. So got time for one more player each?
Yeah, I do. Okay, let's do it. The first guy, you would know him because he played at Georgia, is the kid Charlie Werner, the big
tight end. Yeah.
You know, he's interesting to me because this is such a big class of well-known big tight ends. You got the Hopkins kid at Purdue and the kid from Missouri. I mean, there's so many different tight ends that everybody's talking about going top 10 or 15 and stuff. And when I watched Georgia, and mainly because I was looking at Fromm and I wanted to look at Fromm and get a feel for him, here's this big, long tight end who runs pretty well for a big kid making catches. Now, he's not putting up ridiculous numbers like some of these other tight ends, but when I look at this kid move and I see his ability to adjust to make tough catches for a big kid, I just sort of think, you know, there's something to this kid that if I'm sitting there day three, top of the fourth or top of the fifth round, and this kid's sitting there, wow, he'd be an intriguing guy to take a gamble on because there's some upside and potential there for a big athletic kid. And there's something about him that just jumped out at me. And I did like the fact he is a competitive blocker. Now, he's not great because he doesn't always play with base when he's doing that. But with his size, there's something there. I think you could use him. If you used him the right way, you could get a productive pass-catching tight end.
Very nice. Very nice. You know, guy who I hope shows up at the North Carolina A&T or shows up at the HBCU combine that we were talking about on offline a little bit is North Carolina A&T wide receiver Elijah Bell. He's 6'1", 225. I think I've talked about him before. So I'll put that aside because I did. That was another conversation. One thing that I do want to ask you, though, and it's kind of distracted me when I heard you say it, was Jake Fromm. What did you think of Jake Fromm? Because and maybe we can frame it from the standpoint of, what do you think of Jake Fromm's potential to be an NFL starter?
You know, I really like it. I think a lot of people this week and I don't know if he's announced if he's throwing, but I can't envision him not throwing at the combine. I think he's going to surprise a lot of people with his arm strength. I think he has the arm to make all the throws. And no matter what people tell me about his weight, I still think he looks like a stick figure when I watch him on film. That's probably my biggest concern. But I think mentally he's there. I think quick release is there. I think ability to make off angle, like can't think of the word
here. Off platform, yeah.
Throws. He can do it. I really like the kid, and I really think that if he does well throwing the ball, I know he's going to kill it in the interviews. I could see him making a run up boards to challenge to be the third quarterback, because there's something about this kid that I think mentally he may be a little bit ahead of, firstly, maybe ahead of all of them, but just in terms of if it legitimately is going to be Burrow at the top and Tua somewhere after him, and it's a Bear and this kid, I could see a lot of teams saying, you know what, I'm going to take Fromm. I feel a little more comfortable with this kid.
Yeah, I would. That's where I'm at. And it's, and I think that Fromm is, you know, I'm not a big Georgia fan, but I've seen enough of his game that, you know, I've heard the comment that, you know, he's just a technically smooth looking quarterback who can't play. You know, I've heard some people say that, and they say it in a very, how would I put it? Just kind of casual way. They don't mean it as literally as I just put it.
Yep.
But they kind of say, yeah, he's going to get exposed. You know, the arm velocity is not there. But I've watched him make some throws. There's some plays against, I believe, Notre Dame I saw recently, you know, saw where you see him make some of those off platform plays that with the accuracy that I go, I've seen that throw before. They're in the NFL.
Yep.
And the throw that I've seen in the NFL like that, who's the guy who's made that throw that people just go nuts about, is Russell Wilson. I've seen him make throws that Russell Wilson makes that you go, that few people make in the league. You know, they're that rolling to your right, you know, with that requires anticipation and pinpoint accuracy from about 30, 35 yards. That you're like, it has to have enough velocity on it to get there on time, but it's more about that, you know, the velocity to do it while you're off platform is interesting to me. And when I see some of the throws that may be issues with velocity, they're kind of on the borderline to me. Like, yeah. I look at Jake Fromm and I see a player who is what people thought Kirk Cousins would be coming out of school, and maybe took Kirk Cousins a little longer to get there.
Yep.
But I think that Fromm is a guy who has that kind of potential to be a good NFL starter and maybe even better than people expected. I'm probably going to be watching him again this next week. I just finished through the Bear of the wide receiver class that this is. That's like, made me afraid if I was, I thought I might not be done till May, just getting to look at these guys at the rate I was going. but I'm going to look at Fromm again, but he's number three. I don't know where to talk about rankings right now, but like, he's number three on my board. And for a while he had a healthy lead on everybody as my number two guy. And now he's like, he's just behind Tua in my grades, and on a level where it's like, yeah, I'd prefer Tua, but not by so much that if someone made a huge argument to say we could pick these players and get Jake Fromm.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say, go for it. Let's do it. Let's take that chance, you know? And if we fail on Jake Fromm, well, we got those players and we'll go back and try and get it. We'll try again. But it's like, that's, to me, a pretty telling statement. I agree with you. There's something about him, and maybe he didn't have a great season this year, but there are a lot of new receivers he was playing with. And some of them were guys that if you had a Bruce Pickens, who we're going to be talking about on this show, if we're still doing this 2-3 years from now, he's a freakish AJ Greenish, maybe bigger, you know, type of guy. If you're a quarterback and you have that kind of a guy, aren't you going to start trying to take chances with certain types of throws
to see
what this guy can do and may not work out for you? Of course you're going to do that. So he's not going to look as good, but you also got to give that guy the opportunities in ways that you might not have done otherwise for the past 2 to 3 years.
And I'll say this is I just think if you took that final game against LSU, where he really did make some just decisions that you just were like, come on now.
Yeah.
Like, if that was the first game of the season and that wasn't so in everybody's mind, I think all the people online that are quote-unquote draft experts wouldn't be killing him. They'd be saying, yep, he got better and better and better, and look where he is now. But because that final game was such a disaster, and it was, because every drive I kept saying, all right, he's going to get it together, he's going to do the right thing, and then he would just either misread the play or force a ball or not see cover, whatever it was, he was off. There was something wrong with him that day. In my opinion, it was just one of those days. He had a terrible day. But that one game, I think, has changed the viewpoint of the general media. Because if you eliminate that game, there are not many blatant mistakes during the year that this kid made mentally, whereas a lot of other quarterbacks made a lot more errors than this kid did, and they're not even getting any type of ripping, whereas this kid gets destroyed, and it's really, I think, off that one game.
Well, all I know is that he certainly is a guy that a number of teams are probably going to be really thrilled if he winds up in the second round, landing to them. And because, that intelligence factor on the field is big. And, I remember a certain MVP Super Bowl champion quarterback this year who also had a horrible game against LSU a few years ago. Yeah. And people went off about that LSU game. That's all I heard online was watch the LSU game. That's his, that shows you why he is what he is. But it's funny because it's fascinating how that is in terms of the look, in terms of that player. I was going to say something to you that slipped my mind, but oh well.
Well, I'm just going to throw in something here because I was talking with Rick Saratella. We were doing our podcast, and he brought up Fromm because he said, when you think about all the attributes that everybody talks about, how intelligent he is, how accurate he is, how poised he stays, he said, doesn't that sound a lot like Brady? He said, doesn't this seem like the guy the Patriots might take at the end of the first round and say, that's our next quarterback? Because he has so many of those Patriot traits that it just seems like a perfect fit.
It really does. It would be a great fit for a team to be able to get a guy like Fromm. And it is, he's going to be one of the fun players, I think, in this class to track how they wind up,
No doubt. Well, he's one of my favorites to watch.
Yeah, for sure. And this was a great hour. I mean, obviously as you can tell folks, we could probably do this for 3 or 4 hours and then the family would come home and go, we'd like to have some dinner right now or kind of thing. So, on that note, we hope you guys have a great weekend. Enjoy watching the combine or finding out who your favorite player in college, how they've done. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that over the next couple of weeks. And you can follow Russ Landy at Russ Landy on Twitter. You can find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter. And of course, the rookie scouting portfolio will be available, the pre-draft, April 1st. You can download it. Learn more about that at mattwaldmanrsp.com. And certainly there's a lot of information about it there that you can check out. I promise you, you'll get a lot of good info out of it for the skill positions available. For Russ and I, thanks again. Have a good weekend.